Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
Welcome to True Crime Cast. I am John, but minus Jamie today. Jamie is not feeling well. The flu has been going around Kentucky with a force that is unrivaled by anything I can think of. And Jamie's entire family, including him, are down for the count. So our prayers go out to them. They're going to recover fine, but I don't want him in the booth with me today to record this. And so I am going to do something we don't typically do. We have a case that I could bring to you, but I really wanted Jamie in the studio with me to record that one. I don't want you guys to hear me ramble by myself for 45 minutes. So something that we don't like to do is to bring out a Patreon case from the archives. But today I wanted to do this one because it is one of our most requested cases. And it is one that we have not put out publicly, but it has been available on Patreon since June of 2021. So I want to play for you today the Fred and Rosemary West case from Patreon. And I tell you guys all the time, these episodes are exclusive only for Patreon members. But I hope that you would forgive me in making this exception. While I think it's a really good case, I wanted to get it out there to you all. And I wanted you to hear both Jamie and I instead of just me. So keep in mind when you record this, this was about 4 years ago or so, and our technology and recording equipment has gotten better. So if the sound is not what it is, what you are used to, please forgive me on that as well. But anyway, guys, I want to go ahead and get this started for you. And again, Jamie, if you're listening, our prayers go out to you and hopefully a fast recovery. And we'll see you next week on True Crime Cast. Guys, we love you. And I'll see you next time. Welcome to True Crime Cast Patreon Edition. I'm John, here as always with Jamie. What's happening, brother?
Hey, John.
You know what happened last night?
You didn't sleep.
Do you know why I didn't sleep?
I do, unfortunately.
And tell our fans why.
There's a full moon, and John is apparently a werewolf.
Every stinking time there's a full moon in the last couple of years, I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and not able to go back to sleep. Like, you joked about it. Ha ha, you might be a werewolf. Like, there might be something happening there. Like, I might actually be a werewolf.
Have you ever woken up somewhere other than your house? Or with, like, any kind of blood on your clothes?
No, but there was one time I woke up with like the taste of garlic and the sunshine later that day really hurt my eyes. I don't know what that's all about.
That's vampires, John.
Oh, well, whatever.
Wrong mythical monster.
So what are we doing today, buddy?
We're recording a podcast for like the 20th day in a row. Memorial Day weekend has thrown a wrench into what we're doing. So we are recording a lot of stuff in a short amount of time. But this is Patreon, and we love you guys. So there's no way we were going to let this one go. We're recording this one early to make sure it's top notch.
We are talking about a case. Like, are we certain we've never talked about this case? I feel like we have.
You and I have talked about it, and every time it's brought up, I'm like, no, we're not covering that case. It's too graphic and awful.
So we're going to be talking about Fred and Rose West. So buckle up, and if you are going to be offended by acts of sexual assaults or other tomfoolery, this may not be the one for you.
I don't think that's the right use of the word tomfoolery, but this is horrible and graphic. Patreon used to be such a happy place.
Well, we hired a new writer, and I think that she might be more morbid and demented than we are.
Yeah, so.
And she's family.
Yeah. So, well, and she's probably about the same morbid, and maybe she's also a werewolf.
She married into it, so she might not have known what she was getting into. Welcome. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. In June of 1961, police arrived at the house of then 21-year-old Fred West. A phone call had been made by his mom that a then 13-year-old Kitty West, Fred's sister, told her that Fred had been molesting her since December and that she was now pregnant with his child. So
right off the bat,
here we go.
Let me say, get her rolling. And now we've already got a pregnant kid and a child molester.
After police came, Fred openly admitted that he had been touching his sister inappropriately since at least his early teenage years. So it had been happening for a long time. And then he said, wait, doesn't everybody do that?
No.
No, Fred.
They certainly do not.
They don't do that, Fred. He stood trial November 9th, and even though his mom was mad at him, she spoke on his behalf. His sister refused to testify, and the case fell apart, and Fred was back on the streets.
So let's go a little bit more into his background. He was born September 29th, 1941, so this is right at the beginning of World War II. Pretty familiar with that. Anyway, he was born in,
England.
England. Let's go with that. You know what? I love you guys. You all are here long enough. You know that I can't pronounce words in America, let alone words in other countries. So, Herefordshire.
So I have a new coworker from England, and I fully intend to ask him how to pronounce these beforehand, but I forgot about this one, so my bad.
Fair enough. Well,
Herefordshire.
Where is he now?
Herefordshire, England.
He was the first surviving child born to his parents, Walter West and Daisy Hill. By 1951, Fred's mother had given birth to 8 children, with only 6 surviving, and Fred was apparently her favorite. Fred and his siblings grew up on a farm where their father worked as a milking herdsman. All 6 West children were expected to work to sustain the family, with the girls picking strawberry and hops and the boys harvesting wheat and hunting rabbits. So I mean, this is technically like, I'm going to call this like, I don't know, 1940s, 1950s is a long time ago, relatively speaking, but I don't know. This seems like a much older family. Like, I'm talking like 1800s. Like, it seems like they're living off the land and everybody has to pitch in just to survive.
Well, I mean, probably their parents grew up during the Depression, so this was kind of their mentality.
Did England have the Depression like America?
I forgot where we were, but it sounds like they're just like drinking strawberry beer and eating rabbit meat all the time. So
I think the strawberry and hops were two different things.
I don't think they were. I think strawberry wine and bunny bread.
Now I want to sing strawberry wine.
That's a good song.
Strawberry wine. Oh, gosh.
You didn't have to do that.
Guys, I'm sorry. And I love you. And thanks for sticking around. So the need to survive instilled a strong work ethic in Fred. But unfortunately, it also instilled a lifelong habit of petty theft. Petty theft was the least concerning aspect of Fred's early childhood. However, he claims that he was introduced to sex by his mother at the age of 12, where she instructed him how to perform in acts of bestiality. So, wow. Any commentary there from you, big fella?
Remember when I said we've talked about this case before and decided not to do it?
It's coming back to me. I remember that we researched this case, had started to write it up, and then didn't do it anymore. And then somehow I forgot about that and asked Alora to write it up for us.
Thanks, Alora.
Fred also went on to claim that incest was normalized for him around the same age after he witnessed his father molest his sisters. There is skepticism around the allegations that Fred made against his parents, as Fred's brother has gone on record to say that the claims of sexual perversion on behalf of his parents were just all around a fantasy on Fred's part. Listen, I'm going to tell you, like, in what I do for a living, I've seen stuff like this before, and it is very traumatic for kids. And, you know, whether it happened or not, all signs seem to point that something was going on in Fred's life.
There was a lot going on in his life. He wasn't a very good student, and he couldn't read very well. Anytime in school he got in trouble or he got bad grades, his mom would go and confront the teachers, apparently going as far as fist fighting them. So around 15, Fred decided to drop out of school. He was pretty good with his hands and woodworking, and he was a decent artist. So he decided that having his mom embarrass him at school wasn't worth it and went out on his own. In 1957, he and his brother John went to a youth club, and Fred would aggressively pester the females there, who he objectified as objects for sexual gratification, going back to that perversion you were talking about earlier. This ultimately escalated to him standing trial with sexual assault allegations made by his sister that we talked about earlier. It was noted at trial that Fred had sustained some serious injuries after crashing a motorbike that he bought shortly after his 17th birthday. So brain injury, something we see a lot of with demented individuals later in their lives. The defense argued the accident had left him impaired and not able to process his emotions or really control his impulses due to the brain damage. That's part of what allowed him to walk free. And, of course, there was no evidence, and since Kitty didn't testify, that had nothing to go on. What was not brought up in trial was that 2 years later, Fred suffered another injury when he stuck his hand up a girl's skirt on a fire escape at the youth club we were talking about earlier, and she punched him, sending him down two flights of metal stairs. You know, I hate seeing anybody get a traumatic injury, but good for her. After the trial, Fred's family disowned him. His mother kicked him out of the house, and he moved to another town and moved in with his Aunt Violet. In 1962, he kind of made amends with his parents, but most of his other relationships with family members were tense at this point.
Despite his dark past, Fred would go on to marry and have children. He became acquainted with Catherine Renee Costello in September of 1962. Now, the two would date for a short amount of time until Renee returned to Scotland. And at some point during her time away from Fred West, Catherine had become pregnant by an Asian bus driver. So she's messing around on Fred. So there is speculation that Renee returned to England from Scotland after disapproval from her family about having a mixed race child. When Renee returned, her and West continued their relationship. So Renee was pregnant when they were married on November 17th, with the only guest in attendance being his brother, John. So you mentioned John was, it kind of sounds like John and Fred are probably the closest out of all of them, right?
Yep.
In 1983, Renee gave birth to her daughter. And in order for the family to explain the daughter's mixed race, West and Renee made up this lie that Renee had had a miscarriage and that this child was an adopted child. So how would you like to live and grow up with that over your head?
That your parents are so ashamed or embarrassed that they tell people you're adopted, even though you're not. We usually see the opposite, people covering up an adoption.
I don't know, man, this is just one of those messy family situations that I see all the time where this daughter was not Fred's, but they made up an adoption story to cover up an affair, basically.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's good times in this family. Fred began working as an ice cream driver to support his family. And I mean, that just further concretes the stereotype of ice cream truck people being the creepiest people on earth, right?
Absolutely.
In 1964, West and Renee had a daughter of their own. This child was named Anna Marie. The family nanny, Isa McNeil, and several of West's neighbors expressed sympathy for Renee. McNeil said that Renee was a considerate mother struggling to raise two children, and that Fred was a horrible father and an equally horrible husband. So listen to this, man. He made a bed with bars at the bottom of the girls' beds to basically enclose them like animals in a cage, and they would only be let out when Fred was at work. That is one of the most nuttiest things I've heard on this podcast. he made cages for his kids, and he kept them in a bed cage until he was gone for the day.
Yeah, absolutely horrible abuse, neglect, awful, evil stuff.
Well, and because of everything going on with Fred and his relationship with Renee, obviously strained, she was just afraid to correct Fred's behavior. I mean, it's very typical, power and control, domestic violence type stuff that Fred's exhibiting. And of course, Renee is going to be apprehensive to bring it up because of what retaliation Fred could have.
According to the nanny, the West became friends with Anna McFall, a 16-year-old that was grieving the loss of her boyfriend. McFall spent a great deal of time at the West's apartment. It was around this time that Fred admitted to having sexual affairs on his wife. So in return, his wife started having an affair with a man named John McLaughlin. This is three new characters in a row whose last name starts with Mick, and I'm getting a little jealous. I wish my name was Jamie McJamie. Once West discovered this affair, he became violent. He punched his wife in the face, infuriated. Her lover attacked Fred West in return. West would draw a knife, cutting him in the abdomen. When McLaughlin punched him a second time, he stopped defending himself. McLaughlin recollected the fight years later, saying, this is a quote, "He wouldn't tackle a man, but wasn't slow in attacking a woman." The affair continued, McLaughlin becoming a protector of Renee and her children, resulting in McLaughlin beating Fred any time it became apparent to him that he was abusing his wife and daughters. So this guy's really stepped in as kind of a defender for this family against the husband, where he will protect them, but he's still the other guy, which makes this even more complicated. On November 4th of 1965, Fred actually ran over and killed a small child with his van. Although he was acquitted of all charges, he got worried about the backlash he would get from the public, and he relied on their business to sustain his family. So if people stopped patronizing his business, then they wouldn't have a way to eat. So he picked up and moved his wife, his daughters, his nanny, McFall, who had moved in with them, all to a new town. Shortly after the move, he became a truck driver. By 1966, he had started to show signs of total domination over McNeil, who was the nanny, McFall, and Renee. It was also around this time that he started sexually assaulting his daughter, Charmaine. The assault escalated to the point that Renee started to fear for the life of her, her children, and their nanny. She called McLaughlin, who was still back in Scotland, begging him to come and rescue the three women. At this point, McFall had become infatuated with West, and the two had begun an affair, with Fred promising to marry her eventually and leave his wife. Now, it's speculated that McFall told Fred of the plan for McLaughlin to come and rescue them. So he got home when McLaughlin did, and McFall was strangely calm when she told the other women that she had intended to stay as a nanny for the children. An altercation ensued between McLaughlin and West, which resulted in the police being called after Fred was hit while he was clinging on to his kids. McNeil, Renee, and McLaughlin left. Fred threatened to kill Renee if he were to ever see her again.
So this is pretty tense. Like, this is, I said it before, this is messy. Like, I don't know. Have you ever heard of any other family situations like this? Like, I feel like this is just weird for me.
It's like a really over-the-top reality show.
It seems like a really bad soap opera, but this is real life.
Yeah.
Like, we have a lady who, she and her children and potentially the nanny are being abused, and the mama calls her lover from another country to come and rescue the children, and then he gets there and a fight breaks out.
Yeah, everybody's having affairs. Everybody's cheating on everybody. Fred's molesting and abusing everybody. It's an absolute cluster.
So I've summarized that correctly. I just want to make sure I'm good to go.
Yeah, as bad as can be expected, almost.
Okay. So to make sure that her daughters were being well taken care of, Renee would visit her children often. Despite her initially remaining friends with McFall, Renee soon began to resent her presence around her daughters. On October 11th, Renee, in an act of resentment, stole some of Fred's possessions from the caravan that he and his children were living in. Renee stood trial, where she was sentenced to 3 months on probation, and Fred admitted to having McFall living with them, but lied and said that she was going to be returning to Scotland.
Yeah, even though they were pretty upfront with people about their affair locally, they weren't about to admit it in court.
Letters McFall sent to her family indicated that she believed that her and Fred would soon become married and live a happy life. She tried to persuade Fred to divorce his wife so that he could marry her instead. Now, this would ultimately not be what Fred had in mind. In July of 1967, 18-year-old Annie McPhail, who was pregnant with Fred's child, vanished. Now, she was never been reported missing, but she was discovered in a cornfield between March Macy and Kempsey in June of 1994. Did I say any of that correctly?
I'm all in on it, man. That's how I would have said it.
Several of her limbs and bones were missing and speculated to be kept as keepsakes, and her unborn child had also been cut out. This is a freaking nightmare.
Yeah, she was mutilated. The child was removed, and she was put in a location that they hoped she would never be found.
Fred denied the allegations of killing McFaul, but confided in one individual during an investigation that he became so enraged one night after an argument with her that he stabbed her. Now, this matched up with the state that McFaul's body was found in. In August of 1967, Renee came back to Fred, and the couple relocated. Like, why come back to Fred?
The last time he saw her, he said, "If I ever see you again, I'm going to kill you." And then he had her, he took her to court for theft while he was having an affair on her. And then all of a sudden, his mistress disappears and she moves back in.
You know, and I know that because of what I do, like, it's common for women to come back. But, like, you see this play out and you're just like, why? You know this is going to be a bad idea. There's been zero good things happen so far.
Yeah.
Anyway, their relationship began to improve. At least that was the perspective. But Renee left the following year again, leaving her children in Fred's care. When Fred was not able to take care of them, he placed them in the care of social services. And I know that's an awful thing, but it's probably in their best interest.
Right. And so, John, we're about 19 minutes in. Let's get started with our story, which is when Fred meets 15-year-old Rosemary Letts. This was in 1969. Now, initially, Rosemary was apparently repulsed by Fred's dirty and unkempt appearance, but eventually she was charmed by him. And over the duration of a week with them sitting at the bus stop together, he asked her twice to go on a date, and she declined. But he discovered that even though she never had a boyfriend, she was pretty promiscuous. Fred attempted to gain sympathy out of her by telling her that he was a struggling father, that he had two kids at home, that his wife had completely abandoned them, which at this point was not true because he had given them over to social services. After discovering that Rose worked in a nearby bread shop, he decided that he would become a fan of bread and stop by there regularly. And eventually, after him asking her over and over again, she accepted a date proposal. Shortly after, they got in a pretty heated relationship. And I don't mean like hatred. Like, things heated up pretty quickly for them. She would frequently visit the West kids when he was allowed to see them, and she would help take care of them when they visited. And initially, she was said to be the caring and kind lady that was really hoping to help Fred rebuild his family. In the early stage of their relationship, she left her job at the bread store to nanny for the West children when he did get them back in custody. This was based on an agreement that Fred would supply Rose with money to take care of her parents, and that she would stay there and work to take care of the kids instead of working at the bread store.
And how old is Rose at this time?
15 when they meet.
Okay. And social services gave the kids back to Fred?
Yes.
I just wonder, like, nowadays, you would hope that they would be aware that he is living with a 15-year-old at this point, you know? Like, man, I wish they knew more.
Yeah, I hope they didn't know more at this point.
I'm assuming they didn't, but man, like, that's just crazy to think that they gave them back to this man who is actively in a relationship with a child.
Well, Rose's parents weren't big fans of it either. Her mother, Daisy, correctly concluded that Fred was a pathological liar, and his dad, who was a schizophrenic of his own right, who is alleged to have sexually assaulted Rose during her childhood, threatened to call police if Fred continued seeing his daughter. So this is an awful man calling out a man that he thinks might even be more awful.
It's the pot calling the kettle black situation, and I refer to this as a Charlie Foxtrot.
Yes.
This is just a cluster of a mess.
Completely agree. But of course, Rose defied her parents, as so many teenagers do, which resulted in her parents calling social services on the couple. They told social services that their daughter was dating a much older man, and they had heard rumors that he was encouraging her to participate in acts of prostitution. Shortly after this report, Rose was taken from Fred's home and placed in a home for troubled teens. Rose was only allowed to leave on weekends to visit her parents, but inevitably she would find some time during her weekends off to meet up with Fred.
Yeah, and on her 16th birthday, Rose was released back to the custody of her parents. Fred was at that point serving a 30-day sentence at the time for unpaid fines and petty theft. Again, it's just kind of his habitual thing. Once he was released, Rose left her parents to move into Fred's flat that he was living in at the time. Shortly after Rose moved in, Fred was able to get Anne and Charmaine back from social services. Rose's father made up one final attempt to stop Rose and Fred's relationship. In 1970, Bill had his daughter examined by a police surgeon that confirmed a then 16-year-old was pregnant with Fred's child. Any thoughts there so far, buddy? I just kind of wanted to process it a little bit.
I wish I could say I was surprised here. I mean, he had already impregnated his 13-year-old sister, so this is not out of the norm for him. This is actually a little bit more normal than it being a sister, even though
awful. I don't even think you can say that.
Yeah,
like, this whole thing is just bad. I feel like I'm at work again. I just want to talk about somebody being murdered and not like this horrible family dynamic.
Take heart. We'll get there.
Rose was once again placed in care, but was discharged on the grounds that she could terminate the pregnancy and return to her parents. Instead, Rose returned to Fred, resulting in her father banning her from ever returning to their house again. So she's went to Fred, and her parents, or her dad specifically, have said, enough. Basically, you've made your bed, now lay in it. Fred.
I mean, I feel like her parents tried really hard to keep her away from them. Maybe there were other things they could have done, but this certainly wasn't something they ignored, and they finally realized that their efforts just weren't going to work.
Shortly after that, the couple would leave Fred's flat, and they would move to a ground floor, like two-story house somewhere else. On October 17th, 1970, a 17-year-old Rosemary Letts gave birth to a girl, and the couple named her Heather Ann, and there is speculation that the father of the child was actually Rosemary's father. And not Fred.
Again, another layer to the cluster.
Fred was imprisoned at the time, leaving Rose to look after the three girls, and she told the girls to refer to her as their mother. According to Anne Marie, the girls endured severe physical punishment and torment at the hands of Rosemary. You know, I mean, man, this girl has just been through it all, and now she's in charge of three girls. I mean, it's just not going to go well. While Anne Marie would often cry and show emotional distress during her punishments, Charmaine remained calm and even kind of antagonized Rose by saying, our real mommy wouldn't swear or curse at us, and mommy would come save us. Man, breaks my heart. And yeah. I'm usually the one who can talk about this kind of stuff better than you. I don't know, better than used the right way. But
well, I've been staring at my phone and you haven't. So.
I'm generally more desensitized to this stuff, but for whatever reason, my lack of sleep is making me have a hard time with this. So a friend of Charmaine, Tracy Giles, who lived in the upstairs apartment of the house, remembered a time that she came over to visit and she saw Charmaine naked and gagged with her hands behind her back, standing in a chair as Rose stood alongside the child with a wooden spoon. Now, Anna Marie's face was blank at the time, and she was just kind of watching it happen. Hospital records reveal that Charmaine had sustained a severe ankle puncture. And this incident was explained by Rose having a household accident. So now there's documentation of like severe physical abuse and just awful, awful stuff.
Yeah, that's physical, emotional. I don't want to be here. Now, before Fred got out of prison, many people believed that Rose would go on to kill Charmaine. She had attempted to explain Charmaine's disappearance by stating that the girl's mother had picked her up to go live with them in Bristol. But when speaking to Charmaine's school, she told them that she had moved with her mother to London. So she's telling a lot of people different stories about where Charmaine is. A concerned Anna Marie had asked her father on his release from prison why her mom would take Charmaine and not take her. He was noted for saying, quote unquote, because you're the wrong color, love. She wouldn't want you. Remember, Charmaine was biracial. Charmaine's body was stowed in the coal cellar of the house at Midland Road until Fred was released. When he got out, he buried her naked body close to the back door of the apartment and remained adamant that he did not dismember her. The autopsy, once they finally discovered the body, showed that the skeleton was missing several fingers, several toes, and it's speculated that those were kept as keepsakes by Rosemary.
You know this, I mean, like when they found the last victim, the unborn child was removed, and then she was also missing limbs. Like, what's up with this dude doing this? I mean,
and he's not going to stop that. We're going to see that for several more victims as Fred and Rosemary go on their rampage. And Renee, who was distraught with the well-being of her kids, went to confront Fred. She hadn't picked up Charmaine. She didn't know where she was. She had obtained the address of his house and drove to confront him. But this was the last time that Renee was ever seen alive. She's believed to have been murdered by strangulation, possibly in the back seat of Fred's car after he got her drunk. When she was finally found, a short metal tubing was found in the remains, leading some people to believe that she was restrained and sexually assaulted before her death. Renee's body was also extremely dismembered, placed in plastic bags, and buried near a cluster of trees. In 1972, a year after those murders, Fred and Rosemary hired a 17-year-old girl by the name of Candace Owens to look after their children. Knowing Owens' habits of hitchhiking, they formulated a plan to get the girl to come to their house and fulfill their sexual perversions, knowing that nobody would be looking for her.
So yeah, they picked her up, they attempted to have sex with her, and when Candace refused, they sexually assaulted her. The following morning, having noted Owen screaming when one of his children had knocked on the door of the room in which she was restrained, Fred threatened that he and his wife would keep her locked up in the cellar and allow his black friends to abuse her, and that when they had finished, he would bury her body beneath the giving stones of Gloucester. So, man, just a demented guy and just so evil.
This reminds me so much of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka of just trapping people for the sexual pleasure and doing away with them. And if you remember, Homolka kept a lot of evidence, and that's how she kind of didn't get as much time as Bernardo.
Owen's mother immediately reported her daughter's ordeal to the police, and that the Wests were responsible, and they were arrested and charged with assault. They were also charged with indecent assault, actual bodily harm, and rape. The case was going to be tried, but Owens basically decided that she couldn't face the ordeal of testifying, and basically all charges were dropped. So the West agreed to plead guilty in order to get some reduced charges there, and they were basically just fined, and they were free to go. I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah, this is horrible and awful and words that I can't come up with. I don't know the conversion amount. They were fined £50 each.
Yeah, so when Owens heard this news, of course, she was shocked, and she actually attempted suicide.
Now, their daughter that they had together, or maybe it was Rosemary's father's daughter, she did complain to friends about the abuse that she and her siblings endured, and there were external signs of psychological distress that they really noticed. Staff at her school, which she and all of her siblings went to the same school, had expressed concern as to why Heather, who was really smart and obedient, refused to obey orders either to change her clothing, to shower, or participate in any kind of sporting activities at school. On one occasion, she was forced to take a shower, resulting in her peers and staff noting that her arms, legs, and torso were covered and welts and bruises in various stages of healing. Heather attempted to explain this away as having been in fights with her siblings, but she did tell one close friend that they had been inflicted by her parents, adding that her mother considered her a, quote-unquote, little bitch who deserved her beatings.
When Heather's siblings returned home, they were informed that Heather had left to accept the job that she had previously been refused. And although Rose told an inquiring neighbor that she and Heather had been in a hell of a row, what does that mean?
I think it means a big argument.
Yeah. So, and that Heather had run away from home. Now, later, to answer the children's questions about why Heather failed to contact or visit her siblings, the parents claimed that Heather had eloped with a lesbian lover. When May and Steven suggested they report Heather's disappearance to police, Fred changed his story yet again, saying it would be unwise to initiate a search for Heather as she was involved in a credit card fraud. So on one more occasion, Fred and Rose persuaded an unknown acquaintance to fake a phone call from Heather to her parents. In the years following Heather's disappearance, Fred occasionally jokingly threatened the children that they would end up under the patio like Heather if they either misbehave or divulged the mistreatment that they were enduring to anyone outside of the household. So everybody knows what's happening, and he's using that in like a, I don't want to say passive aggressive way, but like he's holding it over their heads. Like, if you do something, you're going to end up like Heather and you're going to be under the patio too.
That's an absolute nightmare. You know, we talk about how I'm really sarcastic and sometimes come across as crass. Like, there are lines to what I will say, and this crosses pretty much all of them. Her disappearance, Fred and Rose constantly changed their stories about it. And then there were allusions to foul play, the jokes they were making. And that led police to kind of question what really happened to Heather. These inquiries would culminate in a search warrant being issued to excavate the West Garden in February of 1994. In May of 1992, Fred had asked his 13-year-old daughter, Louise, to bring some bottles to a room on the first floor of the home. Now, Rosemary was not present in the room at the time, and shortly after, the girl's siblings heard her scream, "No, don't!" Later, Fred would come back downstairs, and Louise was found by her siblings writhing in pain, sobbing after her father had sodomized her, and at one point strangled her as he sexually assaulted her. When Rosemary returned home, Louise confided in her mother that she had been raped by her dad, and Rose replied, "Oh, well, you were asking for it." Absolute monsters. Louise eventually gained the courage to confide in a friend. And when she did, the friend told her mom, who ended up calling the police anonymously.
You know, our kids are in school, and they get to talk to all kinds of kids who are in totally different situations. And I've told my kids, look, if any kid says anything about being afraid to be at home or it kind of indicates that something is sketchy, like, I've told my kids just to go ahead and tell me about that so that if we need to intervene in any way, we can. And so thank God this kid was able to kind of confide in somebody else, and that person kind of advocated for.
On August 6th of 1992, police searched their house on the pretext of searching for stolen property. Although they found a lot of objects of sexual perversion, a lot of pornography, a lot of paraphernalia, some even homemade pornography, police didn't find a video that had anything to do with Fred's daughters. Louise made a statement detailing that her father had been sexually abusing her since she was 11 and that her mother was completely indifferent about it. The case against the Wests collapsed when Anna Marie and her 13-year-old half-sister Louise declined to testify at the court case on June 7th, 1993, because this went all the way to court, but with the victim expressing her desire to go home and saying she wouldn't testify against them, then there's really, again, nothing to go on at this point. Although the Wests were acquitted of all charges, their younger children did remain placed in foster care even after the trial. Police continued to investigate the disappearance of Heather West, noting there was no indication that she was still alive. And as they went back through Fred's history, they discovered that Renee and Charmaine had disappeared in 1971. There was never a missing persons report filed for either of them. The detective and her colleagues were convinced that Heather was dead and that Fred's repeated statements to his children that her body was underneath the porch might be true. So that's how we get back to that warrant that I mentioned earlier, John.
Yeah, on February 22nd, 1994, police were finally granted the warrant that they needed to search the West residence in order to hopefully find Heather's remains. When police displayed this warrant to Rose on the 24th of February, she turned pale because she knew what was about to happen, right? She would then, like, yell over her shoulder to her oldest son. His name was Steven, and she said, "Get Fred." So, I mean, Rose became making, like, contradictory statements involving Heather's whereabouts. Despite Fred's insistence that Heather had been alive and well and that it had been simply a joke, police began to see that there were definitely some cracks in Fred's explanation. When he saw this, he simply told the police that they were mad because he was acquitted on rape charges. So, yeah.
Yeah, he's obviously scratching for any way to get out of this at this point.
In the following hours the next morning, Fred came to his son Steven and told him that he wanted he and his mother to sell the house and that he had done something terrible. And then he went and turned himself in for the murder of Heather West. So he didn't even let police do their job. He did it for him, right?
Yeah, but they're not going to give up. They're going to find this body.
He confessed to strangling Heather in a fit of rage and then dismembering her on the ground floor bathroom with a heavy serrated knife that he normally used for cutting slabs of frozen meat. He then agreed to come with police the following morning to pinpoint the location of Heather's body. The following morning, police were able to dig up a portion of the yard where Fred had instructed them to, and they found jumbled up body parts and a plastic bag tied with a rope. Now, there were missing fingers, again suggesting the fingers had been removed for torture. Within that mass of bones, police discovered that there were two other sets of human remains present. Fred was formally arrested, and police questioned him about the other bodies that were found, and he finally confessed that there were two other bodies and that he would show police where they were to.
Fred then correctly identified the victims, and he was charged with those murders on February 28th. He would go on to admit that there were even more bodies and insisted that his wife had nothing to do with any of this. He would ultimately say that there were five bodies buried in a cellar, and there was a sixth body beneath the bathroom. Most of these victims, Fred claimed, had been girls he had murdered in the 70s after picking them up at bus stops. Initially, Fred claimed these six victims had been killed when they had threatened to tell Rosemary of his infidelity with them and that he had transported the bodies to shallow graves. The dismemberment, he said, made it easier to transport the bodies. He then offered to take the police to the location of each body that had not been found. How does it make it easier to carry a body by cutting the fingers off?
Yeah, this whole thing is just
calling bull crap. Between March 5th and 8th, police found six more bodies. Each had been extremely mutilated and had shown signs of sexual abuse prior to murder, and also appeared a large serrated knife in each grave. Each body was missing a significant amount of fingers and toes, and when he was asked about that, he didn't say where they were or why they'd been taken off. Now, despite Fred's insistence that Rosemary had no knowledge of this, police believed otherwise, and she would be arrested on April 11th of 1994, initially on charges of sexually assaulting an 11-year-old girl and an abuse of an 8-year-old boy, but she would be held in prison on those charges, and by May 6th, they were both charged with five counts of murder, Rosemary and Fred both continuing to claim her innocence. As well as the murders on the Cromwell Street house, Fred also confessed to the murders of his first wife and his stepdaughter, and he confessed to knowing the whereabouts of Ann McFall's remains. So basically, he's killed every woman that's ever been in his life.
That's pretty much a good summary of this case. So Rose and Fred began to slowly just fall apart after the pressure really started being put on them by the interrogations and everything that was going on. Rose assumed her innocence, playing the role of a grieving mother who had lost her daughter and stepdaughter at the hands of her husband. And this, coupled with Rose's refusal to respond to Fred's letters, made Fred retract his claim that he acted alone. Fred and Rose were brought before a magistrate on June 30th, 1994. Fred was charged with 11 murders, and Rose was charged with 9. Now, immediately after this court hearing, Fred was arrested again for the suspicion of the death of Ann McFall. After his arrest, Fred found himself like more increasingly depressed in prison. This was worsened by Rosemary's public rejection of him at the hearings. Now, Rosemary continued to try to play the victim and declared her hatred for Fred to the media, but dude, she was just as involved as he was.
Absolutely. I think you can just tell by the way she treated his kids that she knew what was going on and she ultimately supported it.
This caused Fred to further his statement by saying that his wife was just as much to blame as he was in all these crimes that were committed, except in the death of Ann McFall, which he claimed was his first wife had committed. So he wasn't saying that either he or Rose were involved in this.
Well, I mean, to go back to that, as soon as she disappeared, Renee did move back in. So,
yeah. So he was on suicide watch, but as soon as it was lifted, Fred West took his own life on January 1st, 1955. And I can honestly say Happy New Year. Like, this is the best part of the story. And if that's wrong, then I'm wrong, right? I mean, this guy is just a freaking nutbag, and I'm so glad we're almost done talking about him.
I'm not going to lose any sleep over it, that's for sure.
He had made a makeshift noose with blankets and bags that he had stolen from the prison, like doing the laundry and stuff. On the bottom of his suicide note was a picture of a gravestone with writing that stated, "In loving memory, Fred West, Rose West, rest in peace where no shadow falls. In perfect peace, he waits for Rose, his wife." I am glad that he is dead.
I really hope they didn't actually put that on his gravestone. In proceedings that followed after his death, Rosemary ended up pleading not guilty to all 10 counts of murder. They had added an additional count after Fred had detailed in a letter that she was involved in Charmaine's death. An important decision made by the judge was to allow testimonies from some of the women that were sexually assaulted by the Wests. Prosecution witnesses included Cromwell Street lodgers, victims' relatives, Rose's mom, Daisy, and sister, Glennis, and surviving victims, including Anna Marie West, Catherine Halliday, Candace Owens, and another witness identified as Miss A, who said she was sexually assaulted by Fred and Rose in 1977 and said that Rose was actually the more aggressive perpetrator there. Against the advice of her counsel, Rose decided to testify. Her affect, sometimes morose and tearful, and was sometimes upbeat and humorous while she was on the stand. In reference to her relationship with her oldest child, Rosemary admitted her relations with Heather were strained before alleging that her daughter was a lesbian and that it had abused her other siblings. The final witness to testify was Leach, the woman responsible for ensuring Fred's well-being and understanding of the case. Fred had began to trust Leach and confided in her that Rosemary and Fred had made a pact that Fred would take the blame for all the murders, letting Rosemary go free. The court adjourned for 6 days before returning. After a several-week trial, the judge reminded the jury that if two parties commit a crime together, that both parties are equally guilty. The jury would return with guilty verdicts for all 10 murders for Rosemary West. She was sentenced to life in prison with the instruction that she should never be up for parole. Altogether, the Wests were believed to have murdered at least 12 people, but prior to his death, Fred hinted to Leach that there could have been as many as 20. Today, Rosemary is being held at HM Prison Newhall, where she still protests her charges and insists that she was innocent. John, this was an absolute nightmare to talk about, and I now fully remember why we didn't do it the first time around, but it is such an interesting case, and it's a really popular case in true crime circles. I totally get the fascination, just not normally our cup of tea.
About halfway through, I zoned out quite a bit. I felt like you. I just didn't want to be in this room anymore, so I'm sorry if that comes across to you all. Like, normally, I'm very involved in this kind of stuff, and I can handle it okay, but I think because of my werewolf situation and not sleeping last night, this one was just a really hard pill to swallow. I do vividly remember now why we didn't do it, and I'm regretting our decision to do it for Patreon.
Yeah, But I know a lot of people have been asking for it. It's one of the most requested cases we haven't gotten to yet. So for those of you on Patreon that wanted to hear it, Happy New Year. Yeah, can we please do something a little lighter next month? Can you get Alora to, I don't know, maybe go for some petty theft? Maybe a little...
Well, this started with petty theft and it ended up being a debauchery.
A little light kidnapping. I don't know, like something that's not this evil.
Oh my gosh, man. I'm so done. Alora, if you're listening to this, you sick girl. This is messed up. Guys, thank you all. God, from the bottom of our hearts, we appreciate it. Can we just talk a little bit about not murder and child abuse and sexual deviancy for a minute?
That's how I plan to spend the rest of my day, but what do you have in mind?
You talked to your freaking childhood hero on this show. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's going to come out the same day this episode does. We interviewed Chris Jericho for True Crime Cast for a regular episode about serial killer Rob Chalk.
So talk to me like I've never heard of Chris Jericho. Who is Chris Jericho and why is he so important to you?
Chris Jericho is a huge professional wrestler in the 90s. He got a start in the 80s down in East Tennessee, where you're from. A huge star in both the WCW and WWF. He's one of the first headliners of a new organization called AEW. He's also a rock star, lead singer of a band called Fozzy, who travels all around the country. They're on the card for Louder in Life Louisville coming up in the next couple months. But yeah, such a great entertainer. Wrestling's about entertainment, right? And he had one of those awesome, engaging personalities and was just always somebody you were excited to see come on screen. And when he came up on our computer screen to video chat with us last week, I was done.
I mean, we talked about it a little bit on Bless Their Hearts on a recent episode over there. But, I think Chris Jericho, I definitely have memories of him being a wrestler that was on TV when I was watching, The Rock and Stone Cold Steve Austin. Admittedly, probably wasn't, my hero, but everybody knew who Chris Jericho was. Anyway, I'm saying all that to say I was not as nervous as Jamie to be talking to Chris Jericho, although ignorance is probably a little bit to do with that because I just didn't think about it too much and I didn't get myself all worked up. Jamie is laying in my floor in the fetal position just moments before this interview happened, and that's the image I will remember from the day.
I don't know if I was more nervous about meeting him or how I would react if it was all a hoax and it wasn't him. I had confirmed, I had proven that it was him, but we had been texting and emailing for weeks to set it up. And if it showed up and it was some old lady that was like, ha ha, I would have died.
Can you, you've known me for, 12, 13, 14 years now, is there a celebrity that I would get that excited about if I were able to talk with him?
Probably Peyton Manning, I would think. That's the first one that comes to mind. Yeah. Would you get like that?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I would be. But you did so well. If I were able to talk to Peyton Manning, I probably wouldn't be able to get a sentence out. But you did amazing. I was proud of you, buddy.
So we interviewed him for True Crime Cast coming out on the 1st. And he interviewed us for an episode of Talk is Jericho about... Nathaniel Bar-Jonah. So that was a lot of fun too. And he invited us to come back. So I am sitting here counting the moments till I think it's been long enough. I'll ask him if we can come back. So it's probably going to be a few months.
You guys should go check out that episode of the Nathaniel Bar-Jonah case that we collaborated. I'm so tired. That we collaborated with Chris Jericho. We'll probably post that on our social media just so you guys can see your boys over there on Talk is Jericho.
Talk is Jericho, baby. That's the intro.
Probably never need to sing again. I think I sang Strawberry Wine at some point in this case, which is just weird.
How did that happen? How'd we get there?
I don't know. Guys, we love you. We couldn't do this without you. We really, really appreciate you all.
Thanks for all your support. We'll be back next month with a lighter Patreon case. But until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out StoveLeg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. StoveLeg Media, igniting conversation.